Senior Vice President, Investment Officer at 351-8694.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, in the newscast that we just ran from National Public Radio, you heard a story about recent events in Africa in the country of Ivory Coast. And that is the topic for our conversation here in this hour. At one time, as the reporter mentioned, Ivory Coast was probably the most stable and most prosperous country in West Africa. However, there has been a great deal of strife over the past few years. There was a civil war back in 2002 that split the country, and to this day, it is divided between the rebels who control the northern part and the government that controls the south. We'll talk a little bit this morning about some of the recent events there, and we have two guests with us here in the studio. Tom Bassett, he's professor of geography here at the University of Illinois, and he teaches courses on the geography of developing countries. His field research focuses on development and the environment in Ivory Coast, West Africa, where he's been doing field research since 1981. He's written a lot about the subject. Also here in studio with us is Felix Altenreich. He's a doctoral student in chemistry here at the University of Illinois. He was in Ivory Coast this past summer working on a project to build a school in a village there where Tom has done a lot of his research over the past few years. So we can talk a little bit, Felix, talk a little bit about what he experienced there. And also we can try to talk a little bit about, give people some basic background to what's going on so perhaps they can understand the events and particularly this, what is going on now, this effort to try to get a more stable situation and move beyond what's been going on there, this sort of stalemate with this divided country that has been now the fact on the ground for a couple of years. The number here in Champaign-Urbana for people who would like to call in and ask questions, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here.
It's a pleasure.
You know, whenever we do something like this, I always feel that we really need to start out and try to give people some background, and that can, if we're talking about several years of history, that can get to be kind of complicated. Maybe, though, here we could start out by talking a little bit about, say, Ivory Coast before 1999 and after 1999, because that seems that there was a major point between things, the point when things were pretty good and pretty stable and where we are now. Let's talk a little bit about Ivory Coast then. Say, you know, when you, Tom, were first started going there, what were things like so up until 1999?
Well, I would say the key date would be probably 1990, when multi-party democracy was introduced into the country.
Okay.
Prior to that, it was a one-party state, one-party government. Everyone belonged to the same political party. And the head of that party was President Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who was a representative of Côte d'Ivoire, actually, in the French National Assembly during the colonial period. Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, as it's called in English, was a former French colony. Houphouët-Boigny, at independence in 1960, became president and was the head of that party and the country for a long time. In 1990, when multi-party democracy became an option, a crisis began. In terms of politicians seeking an electorate, and it became clear, I think, that no single party could claim an electorate, and began to participate in a politics of divide and rule, in which one party accused the other of being ethnic, religious, regional-based. The other party did the same. And so the divisions, in fact, that we are witnessing today, I would say, date back to that politics of division in the early 1990s, which surfaced in the 1990 elections, the 1995 presidential elections, and in the cataclysmic, catastrophic elections of 2000.
Mm. Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is this coup that took place in 1999,
mm-hmm.
That seemed there, you know, from things just seemed after that point to sort of go from bad to
mm-hmm.
worse.
Mm-hmm.
Was that important, the coup of that year?
Oh, it was extremely devastating to the political stability of the country, which had enjoyed long-term stability. And the violence that ensued after that, the killings in the street, the massacres, unprecedented, unimaginable, shocking to anyone who knows Côte d'Ivoire. And that has seemingly become normalized, unfortunately, in the society, that there are disappearances of people, there are extrajudicial killings, there are death squads that have operated from time again, and there is a politics of division, intimidation, and violence that does not bode well for the future.
As I understand it, one of the things that has been an issue, or at least people have made it an issue, is the question of who is Ivorian.
Mm-hmm.
And are the kind of divisions now, are they in fact real? Is there something about them that are real, or is this, do you think that it's essentially artificial, and that people are finding ways to create divisions that really don't exist in an important kind of a way?
Well, one of the successes of Houphouet-Boigny when he was president was that he united the country. He built this a nation out of a diverse population. And we're talking about up to 60 different ethnic groups in the country. That's a significant achievement. In 1995, when Houphouet-Boigny, who passed away in 1994, his successor, Henri Konan-Bédié, when he came to power, he did so on the basis of eliminating his main opponent from running for office by claiming that he was non-Ivorian, that he was, in fact, born in Burkina Faso and could not run for office. And he also changed the electoral law and the constitution while he was interim president to make sure that only Ivorians, that is, whose grandparents were born in the country, could actually run for office. So the politics of identity, in fact, became very divisive, which basically eliminated Alassane Ouattara, his main opponent, a former prime minister, from running for office, and by extension, marginalized the northern part of the country, because Alassane Ouattara is of the Djula ethnic group and is Muslim, and this view of the north as Djula Muslim was one of these sort of political constructions during this politics of divide and rule. It's a simplification, certainly. The coup d'etat, in fact, in 1998 was in the spirit of resolving these divisions. General Robert Gaye said that he was coming into a clean house, that the country had been teetering on the brink of civil war because of these politics of divide and rule. But, of course, the coup d'etat was disastrous for the mm-hmm. country. This is not the way forward for democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry. I don't mean to exclude Felix from the conversation. Come on, jump in.
Yeah, I feel actually with this multi-ethnicity in Côte d'Ivoire, what I experienced in the village, that was probably one of the most powerful things I have seen in this village. Because in the village in Kashali, there have been three different ethnic groups, and they worked all very peaceful together. They lived together since generation, and it works in village life. And another very powerful thing also is that in the village they have practiced democracy. Probably all the stories what Professor Basev has told about the democracy in Côte d'Ivoire, this is a very confusing thing. I'm completely confused by it. But what I have experienced in the village, that we have made all the decisions together as a group, and we have discussed these things, and afterward we carried out this decision. And that's why it was so possible to construct the schools within 5 weeks, to renovate the school. It was, I think, I'm still amazed at what was possible so within this short period of time with $3,000. And I think why it has happened also is because of the structure of the village, because it's a democratic village and these people, they get along with each other and they are very organized and they know really how to get things done.
Well, let me take a step back because I want to make sure that I want to give you a chance to tell about how it is you happen to go to Ivory Coast in mm-hmm. the first place and about this project that you were involved in renovating this school.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? How did you end up going?
Okay, first of all, it starts actually with this stuff so that I was in graduate school, and I was actually not very happy in graduate school. So I dropped my PhD, so I'm not a PhD student anymore. And I was on a search or so of doing something meaningful with my life. And the stuff that I have done meaningful in my life in the last couple of years was the Cosmopolitan Club. So I'm the president of the Cosmopolitan Club, and we are bringing cultural groups from all different backgrounds together in our house every Thursday. And I love this kind of work. And so I really wanted to expand this kind of work on a worldwide level. So our motto is above all nations is humanity. And I was really desperately seeking also for to get involved in a development project. And my housemate is Moussa Kone. He's one of the students of Professor Bassett. He's from Cote d'Ivoire. And he told me about this village from Professor Bassett, that they really need some help, that there's a school also which is really totally run down and is getting worse and worse every year because of this political events in Cote d'Ivoire. He has shown me some pictures. In these pictures I've seen also that they have not even furniture in the school, that they have not a blackboard, that the goats also are wandering in and out of the school, and the school also was a very, very sad place to look on these pictures. And yeah, and we decided from the Cosmopolitan Club together with our executive director, Andrea Shields, that we really want to renovate the school, that we want to work on that. And I dedicated essentially my last year completely to raise funds for this village. And we carried out, I think, at least five different fundraising events in order to get the money. We get a lot of support also from the community here in Champaign, from the members of the Cosmopolitan Club, from Isaac, Illinois, from the university. And it was an amazing time to raise these funds. And then we managed to get it done. And then I just left. And I stayed there for 2 months in Cote d'Ivoire and 6 weeks in the village, 5 weeks by myself in the village. And I had an amazing time. And we accomplished the project.
Can you talk about this place a little bit more? Because this is a place where you've done field research now going back some time.
Right, yeah. As Felix has indicated, there are at least three ethnic groups, the Sanufo, the Jula, and the Fulani. And it's a village of about 2,000 people that has an elementary school. And once you leave, if you're successful in getting into high school, you leave to go to a city 30, 40 kilometers away. And typically, these kind of projects are based on fundraising within the community. Farmers in this area, their main cash crop is cotton, and they contribute money from their earnings to put a new roof on the house, on the school, rather, or on their warehouses. And this war has disrupted, as you can imagine, the cotton economy, and money is scarce. And so the kind of humanitarian intervention that the Cosmopolitan Club organized and Felix was involved in is very important and makes a big difference.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Tom Bassett, he's professor of geography at here at the University of Illinois, and Felix Altenreich, he's a former doctoral student in chemistry at the university, who is involved with this effort that we talked about here a little bit. He talked about folks at the Cosmopolitan Club. This is a quite an old institution, I think, here on the campus.
Yeah, we are celebrating 100 years this year.
100 years Cosmo Club has been around, and he and the folks there were interested in organizing. They raised money to do the renovation of this school and this village in Ivory Coast, and he was there just this past summer. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Tom, I think you said that, and we talked a little bit about Ivory Coast for a long time being this one-party state, about when you started moving to a multi-party system, then what people started to do is to try to practice the politics of division and fostering and creating division among people. And so we get to the point where we have this election in 2000 where ultimately the man who is running the country now, Laurent Gbagbo, comes to power. What happened in 2000?
Ah, well, General Guy, who declared that when he was the head of the junta, that he was only there to clean house and that he was going to prepare the country for elections in 2000. He was going to step down. And as he was sweeping house, he discovered that this was not a bad place to stay. So he decided, in fact, he was going to run for office as well. Mm-hmm. But he realized he had some opposition out there. And so he he created this electoral commission that was going to validate the candidacy of various opponents, and he succeeded in eliminating all his main opponents except Laurent Gbagbo. And the implication, the story anyway, in the streets of Abidjan at the time was that Laurent Gbagbo had sort of made some agreement with Guy that if Guy won a rigged election, that Gbagbo would become prime minister, and they'd have a kind of agreement there. As it turned out, Gbagbo decided that that wasn't a good arrangement and that he insisted that the vote be counted. And when Guy wanted to stop the vote count, the followers of Laurent Gbagbo that are members of the Ivorian Popular Front took to the streets. And basically, there was an insurrection in Cote d'Ivoire, which General Guy fled by helicopter, and Laurent Gbagbo took power, which led to the next day to massive demonstrations by the opposition saying, well, fine, the election's over, but it was rigged from the beginning. Let's have fair elections now. And these protests were violently suppressed, and 100 people were massacred. So right now the stalemate is about really holding free elections and the conditions in which these will take place.
Hmm. Yeah, I can also say something about these demonstrations. I was on my last couple of days I was in Abidjan because I had to fly out of Abidjan, the capital. And it's actually a very scary thing also to get involved into this kind of demonstration. I wasn't there at all, but I have seen also how the people. I was in at that day also. I was in downtown in order to verify my flight with Air France, and then I've seen that all these people are moving out. That they are taking the buses out into the suburbs, that they want to get out of this place because it might get violent. And that's a pretty scary feeling also when you're there right in the middle. So just get your bus and get back to your safe suburb, Yopogion, which was essentially a middle class neighborhood, which I felt very comfortable in. So I can understand what these people are going through when they try to get politically involved in Cote d'Ivoire and try to make a difference. Mm-hmm.
Is there a lot of violence? Has there been violence now in recent years?
There has. Most recently was in January. Most recently was July and August. In January, this UN I created a group called the International Working Group, which is there to supervise and monitor the electoral process, dissolved the National Assembly, basically, saying that its mandate under the Constitution had ended. And this led the FPI, which dominates the National Assembly, to send its young patriots, kind of a youth militia, into the streets, and also armed militias in the western part of the country to attack UN positions, actually. So the UN camp in the town, the western town of Gingolo, was attacked by these armed militias, and there were some deaths. In July, August, the FPI supporters were trying to disrupt, and did disrupt a... these public hearings, which were taking place at the time, to provide national identification papers to people, which is a prerequisite for, in fact, establishing the electoral lists for this sought-after election. And those public hearings became controversial and were disrupted, and again, there were deaths. So there are these periodic demonstrations that are leading to violence and deaths. And there's also there are militias and death squads that periodically are active.
Well, we did, in fact, have someone who was asking a question off the air about that specific thing, and it, more specifically wanting to know where the funding for death squads that are active there is coming from. How were they supported? Who were supporting them?
Well, of course, this is one of the big mysteries of how is the rebellion being funded, and how are these militias being funded, right? I mean, this is part of the stalemate, I think, is the fact there's a war economy and that both sides are profiting from it. There's parallel economies. Mm-hmm. There's the official one that the prime minister is overseeing, which is based on collection of taxes. And then there's this siphoning off of funds from oil revenues, from cocoa receipts and the South, and that money ends up in certain accounts that is distributed according to the politics of the moment. And the rebels in the North are similarly engaged in this war economy and smuggling cocoa. They control some areas that are cocoa producing, cotton, and they're taxing those circuits and using that money to finance their operations. But there's also, there has to be external funding. And of course, that's the big question.
Hmm. Yeah, and the war economy is also funded by collecting bribes from the population. So for every, so there have been so many checkpoints, you have to go through at least 20 checkpoints until we could reach the closest city to the village, Kohoko. And at every checkpoint, you had to go through this procedure, so checking your passport, checking all your documents if you are legal, and then in the rebel area they collect bribes for these kind of things. This is for American standards is not a lot of money. It's probably they collect $1 or $2 per person, but for these people also it's an awful lot of money, because they have not really the chances to get a cash generating to have a cash generating work. So when they're doing agricultural, they are not able to sell their products on the market. So they have not really much possibilities to generate any financial income. And when they want to travel, when they want to, for example, visit their family, then they have, for every movement they are doing, they have to pay a bribe to the rebel. And for every transport, what is going in and out of the village, you have to pay a bribe. So for all the stuff what we have been transporting into the village, and we have tried it to restrict it to only 2 times of transports for the building materials, we had to pay bribes, and it was for American standards not a huge amount of money from the collected money. It was probably $15 total, but that's a lot of money also for these people there.
Yeah. The rebellion of 2002 that ended up now dividing the country between the northern rebels and the government still controlling the South, was this just a matter of politics by other means? I mean, is that really
well? The rebellion, in fact, is a failed coup d'état. Okay, the intention was to overthrow the government of Laurent Gbagbo, and it failed. But it did succeed in taking the second largest city in the country, Boaké, and in the northern part of the country. That's where things have remained. And there really hasn't been much fighting. There was some, the first, this was, we're talking about September 2002. There was some fighting for a 2-week period. But since then, but very little.
Who now has potential influence to try to resolve the situation? Is there neighboring countries who is in some position to try to get the parties to sit down and say, look, let's see what we can work out here?
Well, this is, of course, the big question. And the UN would like to think it has the authority to move this country forward to its unification and disarmament and peaceful and fair elections. And of course, that's what they're trying to do. And the meetings that are taking place in Abuja today by the economic community, under the auspices of the Economic Community of West African States, is trying to get beyond the current impasse. And what's interesting about the whole politics here of neither peace nor war is that the opposing parties typically agree on the agreements. But once it comes to implementing them, there's a lot of foot dragging. There's a lot of reinterpretation. There's an infinitesimal progress in the end made. And Now, the current discussions that are taking place, there'll be some proposals to give the current prime minister, who was put in place by a UN Security Council resolution, 1633, in October of 2005, which was trying to get beyond this impasse. There should have been elections in October 2005, but they didn't happen. And the idea was to have them happen this October 2006, and they're not happening. The idea was to give a prime minister power to oversee this process of national identification, establishing electoral lists, disarmament, and having elections. And the president, Gbagbo, was supposed to sort of step back and let this prime minister operate, but that's not been the case. And so right now there are proposals that would give this prime minister more power, more executive power, to sign laws, to appoint military and civilian administrators. And so I think there'll be an ultimatum at this point from the UN's perspective, that if this is the last time we're going to postpone elections, and if we don't have them within 6 months or whenever the period is going to be proposed, there'll be more drastic measures. Now, what will those be? Right now, the UN has 7,000 troops in Cote d'Ivoire, peacekeeping forces. The French have 4,000 troops. It's costing $37 million a month to keep these peacekeeping forces in place. Now, the UN doesn't have a large budget for this kind of operation and will not agree to go on for two more years or three more years of this kind of situation. So the proposal would be probably we'll withdraw our troops and let you all resolve this conflict, which would, I think, be devastating given the volatility of the situation, or alternatively have a more strong UN mandate in which the UN would actually take over the electoral process by itself, and which is, of course, an infringement on sovereignty of Cote d'Ivoire and will be fiercely resisted by the government in power. So the UN right now, in conjunction with the African Union and with other presidents, Omar Bongo from Gabon, the president of the Congo, Thabo Mbeki from South Africa, they've all been involved in trying to negotiate agreements. And as I said, they've been successful on one level, but it's been this implementation that's been really slow.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guests. Tom Bassett, he's a professor of geography here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He teaches courses on the geography of developing countries. He's done field research on development and environment in Ivory Coast, West Africa, where he's done field research since 1981. Felix Altenreich is a former doctoral student in chemistry here at the University of Illinois who became interested in Ivory Coast through his involvement with the Cosmopolitan Club, century-old organization here on the U of I campus. They raised some money to do a renovation of a school in Ivory Coast, a project that he was involved in for some time. And in fact, just this past summer, was actually there when in went to Ivory Coast to do that work in a village where Tom has done research now for a long time. And for you were there ultimately all by yourself for
5 weeks.
For 5 weeks and doing that. And then when did you come back?
I came back at the beginning of August. And yeah, I traveled to Cote d'Ivoire in the middle of June. We stayed in Abidjan for 1 week and then we traveled up to the village. We together with Ms. Musa, my partner, we negotiated with the village all the whole project in the first week, and then Musa left for doing research for Professor Bassett, and he traveled around in West Africa, Burkina Faso, Mali, Cote d'Ivoire, and so on, and then we carried out a project. I was staying in a house, at a family, so there was a really nice guy. He was the truck driver of the village, and I stayed together with him and his two wives. And he also had a couple of children, and I really enjoyed the environment there. There was a project manager for the construction, and he was very knowledgeable about hiring all the people. And essentially, I worked with him all together. So how we hired the personnel for carrying out the welding, the construction of the bricks, the painting, and so on. So we negotiated it together, and then we paid the people in close collaboration with the school committee There have been in total, there have been 15 people involved in this committee for reconstructing the school. We had regular meetings on a regular basis, and yeah, and we worked in close collaboration with the whole village. The school project also was essentially a central spot of meetings. So people that just visit us during the construction, during the whole day, they gave us presents. And the children's, they always wanted to help something, wanted to do something, they wanted to play frisbee with me, and of course they also wanted to get their pictures taken. So I have 700 pictures total. So it was a little bit overkill, but it was really great. And I'm in the process of sending the village the pictures, because they really love the pictures. And yeah, it was a very dynamic process of constructing the school.
Yeah, and does Cosmo Club have a website where there are some?
Yes,
can see pictures.
Yeah, there's a website, and you can see a couple of pictures. And I have a personal website generator on the Facebook, which is probably even more accessible for many students. So when you go to the Facebook, so there you can see 120 pictures or so from the school renovation and also from my time in the village.
Okay. Well, again, if people who are listening, if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Do the French retain an interest in what goes on in Ivory Coast? This had been a French colony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the French are very interested in Côte d'Ivoire and all of former French colonies in West Africa. France sees itself as a world power, and part of the basis of that power is its former empire and the influence it continues to have in its former colonies. So it would like to remain influential. It would like to have the support of its former colonies in international fora. And I think this is one of the conflicts, frankly, between the Laurent Gbagbo government and France, is that Laurent Gbagbo is a socialist president that has been writing for a long time about the need to break ties with France to end neocolonialism. And so I think there is this politics of disengagement from France that France is not liking, and France at the same time is finding it difficult to sort of think of a future in which it doesn't wield this sort of paternalistic power and authority. That said, the Ivorian economy is very much tied into France. The French culture. I mean, the French is the national language, and the economic system, the political system, is modeled after the French system. And a lot of investors. The port is owned by a French company. The telecommunication systems are, owned and run by French companies. So there's, I think, a strong political interest in France in maintaining Côte d'Ivoire within its orbit, but it's having difficulty doing that.
Mm. Well, my question would be, what sort of interest are we talking about? Political interest? Are we talking about economic interest? And maybe, in fact, you can't really divorce those things. Mm-hmm. But is it of a matter of the French? They would like to see a stable government there. They would like it to be a friendly government,
right,
so that they can continue to have an economic relationship. But it's not so much the case that they would like to come in and tell and dictate government policy in the country, unless, of course, perhaps it again impacts on economic issues for France or for French business people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. I think, you cannot separate the political and economic interests. I mean, I think economically, Côte d'Ivoire doesn't really represent that big of an economic pie for France. But I think so the politics, the political influence is most important. And there's some interesting signs. The Côte d'Ivoire government is in the process of would like to build a new bridge across the lagoon, and former bridges have been built by French engineering firms, and this one was going to be built by Chinese. Oil operations opened up to American oil companies, Russian oil companies, as well as French. I think Laurent Gbagbo is trying to diversify its economic partners, its political partners, and this is unsettling to France, and which you really don't know what France's coherent politics is towards French West Africa.
Do you, Felix, when you were talking to people, I don't know to the extent that you had conversations about politics, but did people have really strong feelings about what they thought the government should be doing or what the government should be like? Or was it mostly they were just interested in the government essentially leaving them alone?
Very often I had a feeling also that people that just wanted that the government leaves them alone. So I think that was really a common way of talking of the people when you talk with them in a village. They want to have their own culture. They really want to have to preserve their village life, and also what they really want to, they want to have access to the economy again. So these are the things what they want to. They want to be able to work and make a living out of their work. And none of these governments also is supporting this issue for what is so important for the people. And I can completely understand that they really do not want to get involved with any of these politics at all anymore. They want to have a country also where they're able to sell their cotton. They work the whole year or so in order to grow cotton. It's encouraged by France also to grow cotton, and they want to sell their cotton for a reasonable price. And as everyone else, they just want to improve their lives. And this is how I feel, how the people are thinking about this system.
Mm-hmm. You know, times are hard when political conditions are stable. And not with this rebellion and the division of the country into and the disruption of the economy, it's gotten a lot worse. And I'm talking about hospitals closing down, banks are closed in the area. In order for cotton growers to get their payments, they have to travel to Mali, to the city of Sikasso, to get their checks. I agree that there's a desire for return to normalcy, even if normalcy is tough. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If there was a free and fair election, we'll put that in quotes, is there a particular party that would have enough strength so that it could secure enough votes to actually run the government, or would there have to be some kind of coalition formed among a number of parties that would then have to agree, have to get along, and have to work together?
Mm-hmm. Right. Great question. And we've had one, I think, fair election that we can look at. This was the municipal elections that took place in 2000. I believe it was 2000. That it seemed like that the voting was not irregular, that the turnout was good. And it was interesting to see the one of the opposition parties, the RDR party, this party that is from the north, that's associated with the north. Which, of course, what was interesting is that it received votes from all over the country. In fact, in President Gbagbo's hometown, Gagnoa, the RDR party won the mayor's seat. So, if we look at the results of that election, the municipal elections of 2000, it seems that the RDR does have a national following, especially in cities. And I think that is of concern to the FPI, the party in power right now, that if there are free and fair elections, that they may lose.
Mm-hmm. And would the
it's all about power.
Would they have the RDR, would it have a dramatically different agenda or set of priorities that they would use to govern? Would it be a different place if they were running the country?
This is what's really interesting when you sort of look at that for in politics, is that, you know, what's the platform, you know, of these parties? I witnessed some regional council elections in 2002 that was, to me, stunning, because people were running basically on a party platform, just from a party, and just vote for me and you will benefit. There's nothing about, well, we'll improve roads, we'll improve educational system, we'll improve hospitals, healthcare, right? There was nothing concrete in their campaigns. So it's really hard to say, in fact, would an RDR presidency be any different from an FPI presidency? Because the policies, I mean, the RDR, the head of the RDR, Alassane Ouattara, was a former deputy director of the International Monetary Fund. So he does have a reputation of being a sort of a centrist, conservative technocrat. In fact, he was a prime minister under the Houphouët-Boigny government in the early 1990s, and his policies were in that direction. So when one could anticipate that if he did come to power, that he would be a center-right in terms of his policies. Laurent Gbagbo presents himself as a socialist and does have some goals of making health care free and universal in the country. And but we've yet to see any of that because I think of the conflict.
Well, I think you talked earlier about the fact that after there had been this coup, this General Guay took over and was trying to push aside anybody who might be opponents. And one of the ways that he did that with this man in particular, Ouattara, was to say, well, see, you're not really an Ivorian. Mm-hmm. You weren't born here. You were born in another country. You were born in Burkina Faso. So you shouldn't be able to run for president. You're not an Ivorian. If, as far as other Ivorians are concerned, is that a particular issue? I mean, if he and his party, if there was an election, he and his party won, would there be a lot of Ivorians say, "Well, this man's not an Ivorian. He shouldn't be the president." And is that in many people's minds a real issue, or was that just something that Guay came up with as a way of trying to get rid of people who
actually,
might run against
it? It wasn't just Guay. It was actually Bédier in the 1995 election. Mm-hmm. It was Bédier who changed the constitution and the rules for running for office. Yes, I think it is actually. It's become a reality. That the divisions and that have are in place, you see that will be an issue. So that has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Let me just also step back a little bit and point out that there are also other implications of this interpretation of the other, the foreigner, the non-Ivorian, and that has to do with the 1998 land privatization law. And the first article says that only Ivorian citizens can own land. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a very volatile issue because the Côte d'Ivoire, it's a country of 18 million people. A quarter of them are believed to be foreigners. Historically from Mali and Burkina Faso, who have been working in the cocoa and coffee economy in the forest region. And over the years have acquired land through informal means. And now, because of this law, they no longer have right to be landowners.
And it's also very hard to define a foreigner in Côte d'Ivoire because these borders, they have been drawn by France during the colonial period. That there's a border between Burkina Faso and Côte d'Ivoire, I think it's a very artificial thing because in Burkina Faso, there's Sinufo is a very dominant cultural group, and in North Côte d'Ivoire, Sinufo are a very dominant cultural group. They visit each other, they have relatives on both sides of the border, they speak the same language, have the same culture, they have the same economic interests. So it is very hard also to find that as different nationalities. For example, our painter, we have hired a painter. And we fetched him also by motorbike also from Burkina Faso. So one Nolo, the construction director, so he was just driving over with his motorbike to Burkina Faso, which is 3 hours away. He got him on the motorbike and just drove back, and then he was there. And he did not feel anyhow different or foreign or so than the people also who are in the village and have a passport from Côte d'Ivoire or an identity card at least. And I think that's also probably the only issue what is communicated by these parties, what I could experience. This identity issue is probably the only platform what they have so far. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a pretty weak basis because people are interested in more than this identity issue. They are interested in prosperity. They're interested in health system, and they're also interested in a better infrastructure.
Mm. Well, I suppose that, the fact that there are these people who maybe have some claim, although it's contended, having come from someplace else to Ivory Coast, harkens back to that time when things were good. I mean, I'm assuming that Ivory Coast was kind of a magnet. It was drawing people because it was a prosperous place, and people probably thought, well, this is a good place to go. Mm-hmm. And so that makes you wonder, well, is there any, what's the possibility of actually being able to get back to a time like that, when there at least was that, when things were relatively stable, there was that kind of prosperity, and things, and as far as West Africa was concerned, things there in Ivory Coast were pretty good. People were doing pretty well.
I think that's the main interest of the leaders of these West African countries that are meeting today in Abuja. They, the nightmare is a destabilized Cote d'Ivoire because its coastal location is critical for many of these landlocked states. A lot of commerce goes through Cote d'Ivoire out the ports, and they need Cote d'Ivoire to be a stable, prosperous state for them to be stable and prosperous. To get back to this question, David, about the is identity an issue here? Mm-hmm. It's critical. It's central. And it's complicated in many ways. The names of people from Mali and Burkina and Northern Cote d'Ivoire are the same. Ouattara, Kone, it's the Smiths, the Jones, the Browns. But interestingly, during the Houphouet Boigny's era, he gave the right to vote to foreigners because they felt beholden to him because he allowed them to come in and to work in this prosperous coffee, cocoa economy. And Laurent Gbagbo, when he was campaigning for the presidency in 2000, wanted them to not have that right, that only Ivorians should vote. So right now, it's disentangling who's Ivorian, who's not Ivorian is a key issue. And in fact, this peace process that has been in motion involves identification. That's the first thing. Who's Ivorian? Were you born in Cote d'Ivoire? Can you get a national ID card? And once you've got your birth certificate and your national ID card, then you can be considered to be an electoral list. And so this is the process that needs to take place before elections can happen. And this is what's not happening because of the Laurent Gbagbo's party's concern that the RDR will try to allow foreigners to become Ivorian citizens and therefore increase his electoral chances. So this national identity issue is at the center of politics right now.
Yeah. We have certainly time if somebody wanted to call in and ask a question. We have a minute or two left. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Do you expect, Felix, that you're going to try to have some – you're going to try to maintain the connection now that you have formed with this place?
I think it's very difficult to maintain a connection because I'm right now not capable also of raising $3,000 again, because I have to leave this place because I graduate, and the only thing but I will really keep the connection. I try to stay involved in international development. That's my passion. So and right now I'm in Isaac in Illinois, and I'm right now going through a matching process in order to find a work in a developing country. This school project also was pretty much the best thing what I've done in my whole life, and I hope that I can just do something again for work and also as a career. I think there should be possible so that that more people also are able also to do these kind of things. That direct action also you can see also we really make a difference in this village. Direct action also makes really an impact, and there could be so much negotiation going on between United Nations and the government, but it doesn't really directly help the people. And even if this negotiation is going on, one can make a difference. And I hope that I can find an organization also who is dedicated to this kind of idea too, and that I can make a career out of that.
Yeah, it surprises me that such a thing could be possible. Actually, that just a few people should say, here we'd like to do something, and here's a place where we think that there's a need. And so why don't we'll put together it's not a lot of money. I think we were talking about here, and we'll just go and do this. This is not a big organization. It's just a group of people who decided, let's do something.
It's inspiring. Yeah. I agree.
So we've essentially tried to lay out the basics of Ivorian politics, a little bit of a thumbnail sketch, and talked about the difficulty right now, sort of the impasse. What are you, Tom, what do you think is going to happen, or is there any way to say what's likely to happen?
Well, it's really tricky. It's very volatile. That's my concern. And if the ECOWAS and the UN and the African Union recommend that the president's powers be diminished, that more executive authority be given to the prime minister to carry out these elections. And I think the elections are really, really important given the disastrous results and previous one. So they need to be fair and free. And my concern is there'll be more violence in the short term. Because it's about people want to stay in power. And the rebellion is going on. The rebels want power. They want Gbagbo to get out. And Gbagbo cozies up to the Constitution, saying, I'm the constitutionally elected president, and doesn't want to see any kind of interference on how the Constitution is modified to give the prime minister more power. So my concern is that we have to watch carefully what happens in this next month in terms of what will be his mandate from the UN and how will his supporters receive it.
Is the United States, the Department of State, involved in this at all? Is it? I'm sure it's aware. It's paying attention. Is there any sort of direct American involvement here?
There is representation on this international working group, which there are members of African governments. There's members of international financial institutions. The World Bank is in fact represented on this group. So the U.S. has a hand in the current peace process, but it's, I think, letting France take the lead.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you a lot.
Tom Bassett teaches geography here at the University of Illinois. He teaches on geography of developing countries and has done research in Ivory Coast since 1981, research on development and environment there. And Felix Altenreich is a doctoral student, former doctoral student in chemistry at University of Illinois, maybe going on to a career in international development. You don't know, who was in Ivory Coast this past summer doing this project that was funded and sort of organized by folks involved with the Cosmo Club, Cosmopolitan Club here at the University of Illinois. Again, thanks very much, both of you. We appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having us.
Programming here on WILO made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. That's where we'll leave it here. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today on the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with dog trainers Jim Keel and Carol Lindholm. They're with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana, and following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon, they'll be happy to answer your questions about dog care, behavior, and training. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. Kansas December wheat trading at 506, up 1.5. In Chicago now, December wheat 463, down 1. March 475, down 2.5. December corn 272, up 1/4. March 283, down 1/4. May 289.5, down 1.5. December 07, 302.75, down 6. November beans 566.5, up 1. January 580, unchanged. March 590.25, up 1/2. November 07, 621.5, down 2. October meal 167.20, down 10. October oil 23.85, up 3. At the Merck, October feeder cattle, the contract trading at 112.85, down 60. October live cattle, 99.